My name is Dom Aplon, and I'm Director of Research at the Applied Research Center. I'd like to welcome all of you to the Compact for Racial Justice Forum Call on Race and Recession. Before we get started, I'd like to go over a couple of housekeeping notes. I want to inform everyone that this call is being recorded for ARC's use and for the use of other media outlets. ARC will be posting a recording of this and future calls onto our website, arc.org, after their conclusion. We're asking participants as well to direct their questions to us via email. Send your name, your organization, affiliation, if applicable, and the question to compact@arc.org. That's compact@arc.org. For those of you who are unfamiliar with us, the Applied Research Center is a racial justice think tank that bridges policy research, media advocacy, and community activism. ARC is hosting this series of Compact Forum calls because we feel it's important to create a space to share ideas about how to apply a racial equity framework to the flurry of policy proposals coming out of D.C. and state capitals, proposals that will have major implications for people of color and for racial equity in this period. We're now 84 days into the Obama administration's term and 17 months into the current national recession by the government's calculation. The country as a whole is faced with an expanding economic crisis that is spreading fear and instability in places that are not accustomed to facing hardship in emergency circumstances. But for communities of color, socioeconomic hardship is all too familiar. And moreover, this crisis has intensified that hardship. The fact that people of color continue to be pushed to the bottom of our economy and our society is not coincidental. Our communities are saddled with the accumulated weight of long histories of racial discrimination and face contemporary compounding barriers to fairness and inclusion across key institutions within our financial system, educational system, labor and business sectors, health system, etc. The focus of ARC's forthcoming Race and Recession report that we'll be releasing 4 weeks from today on Tuesday, May 12th, and of today's Compact Forum call featuring Bertha Lewis of ACORN and Jose Garcia of Demos, whom I'll introduce in a few moments, is threefold. Number one, we want to discuss how the current economic crisis is impacting people of color today in employment and in housing. We also want to, number two, we want to illuminate the root structural causes of these racial inequities in historical policies and practices. And finally, number three, we want to promote short and long-term solutions that challenge and respond to the pushback that we're already hearing in the mainstream discourse. Our solutions are to pursue expansive economic policy changes that prioritize the poor and working classes in our nation, including those among us who are undocumented. We have to arm ourselves to demand for increased wages, for the legalization of immigrants, and for pro-labor reforms when many of the mainstream experts and policymakers are saying that now is not the time. We're arguing exactly the opposite. Now, amidst this current crisis, there's an opportunity that we cannot pass up. It's an opportunity to build a truly equitable economy. And the first step is to radically shift the debate from our economic system's single-minded profit maximization mentality, a mentality which is indifferent to racial inequities at best, and at worst, actively produces and exploits those inequities. At some point in the not-so-distant future, the mainstream discourse is going to declare that the recession is over. But when they do, we need to be able to say that no, actually, it ain't over until we've built a more inclusive model of sustainable economic growth from the bottom up. With that, I want to briefly draw your attention to two figures that we've just posted on our racewire.org blog. That's racewire.org. That's our blog here at the Applied Research Center. The first figure shows that racial inequities in unemployment rates for the past 35-plus years between blacks and whites in the United States. And what you see there is that unemployment for whites during the worst of times is lower than unemployment for blacks during the best of times. So you see there in that figure, again on racewire.org, that white unemployment peaked at about 9.3% in 1983 during this time period that we're covering, whereas black unemployment at that time was almost 20%. It took some 18 years until about 2001 for black unemployment to drop down to the peak unemployment for whites. There are only about 5 years in that entire 35-plus year period where black unemployment dipped just below that 9.3% that white unemployment, again, peaked at in 1983. The second figure shows racial inequities in median weekly earnings for about the same time period. And it's easy to see from these figures that people of color have had much less capacity to put money away to provide a cushion for themselves and their families during difficult economic times. In both figures, we see that racial inequities have persisted throughout this period and don't seem to be closing at all. In fact, this current crisis threatens to expand those inequities. Now, to discuss this topic today with us, we have, in the order in which they'll be speaking, Jose Garcia and Bertha Lewis. Jose is the Associate Director for Research and Policy at DEMOS, an organization based in New York and in D.C. DEMOS combines research, policy development, and advocacy to influence public debates and catalyze change. DEMOS works to illuminate critical problems and advance innovative solutions. And they work at both the national and state level with advocates and policymakers to promote reforms. And they help to build the capacity and skills of key progressive constituencies. Jose is co-author of Up to Our Eyeballs, How Shady Lenders and Failed Economic Policies Are Drowning Americans in Debt, a book that was released in March of 2008. Jose will be talking to us today about the current racial wealth gap and its root causes in discriminatory policies in our financial system. Bertha Lewis is CEO and chief organizer for the Association of Community Organizations for Reform Now, otherwise known as ACORN. With over 400,000 member families organizing to more than 1,200 neighborhood chapters in 110 cities across the country, and for over 30 years, ACORN has been a force that is committed to social and economic justice. Through their Homesteader campaign, ACORN is working with its membership and activists around the country to build home defender teams. These teams will be prepared to mobilize on short notice to peacefully help defend a family's right to stay in their homes until a fair solution to the crisis is put into place by the new administration. They're also recruiting allies and elected officials to support our efforts and call for a full and comprehensive solution to this crisis. Bertha will be talking to us about the current foreclosure crisis and the longstanding needs for affordable housing options in our communities. Jose, you're first up.
Thank you. Thank you, Art, for holding this phone conversation. Wealth has been one of those areas that our communities of color actually have been left behind. And under the current recession, many families dig deep into their pockets and home equity to stay afloat. For communities of color, this usually is not an option. The median family of color own only 15 cents in net assets compared to a dollar aimed for white families. Furthermore, communities of color homeownership rate have been set back close to a decade just in this past recession, and widening then the gap of homeownership. At the same time, the loss of assets, it could be one of the worst loss of assets that communities of color have experienced. And instead of actually explaining this in America, rather this is attributed more to the legacy of slavery, continuing discrimination, and long-lasting failures in public policy instead of this individual rhetoric that have been fed up to feed us in a wide variety of areas. And today I will talk particularly about the credit market in this realm. You know, credit has been necessary to access wealth from buying a home or actually access to buying a car. We actually, you know, lead you to a job. The main concern have been that actually the credit structure in American society actually have not have been tilted to white families. And historically, in the housing and other credit areas, communities of color have been denied, limited access, or have been costly credit lending to them that actually have depleted the short income or limited asset that they may had. And these have not been just due to deregulation that is definitely a factor, but have been led basically a history of discriminatory policy that actually have benefited few and discriminated for communities of color. We started this infrastructure of lending financial institution actually was started with a good cause in the Roosevelt era with the creation of the HOLOC, actually was to refinance these loans, you know, in the era of depression. But what happened was actually the refinancing mainly white loans, white families' loans, but actually also led the ground rules of the beginning of redlining, creating what are some good neighborhood and bad neighborhood, and all those delineations were actually based on class and mainly on color. After that, we saw the redlining in 1950 based on this policy in 1935, and currently we're dealing with the regulation of financial industry that have actually done very little to actually provide fair credit access to communities of color. Actually, the general idea of the industry have been, you know, I'm just going to put it out there, is that, well, if we let innovation happen, they're actually going to benefit consumer because competition will happen. And if competition happens, then we will compete for consumers. And then consumers, no matter their color, will get better products. And this has been totally more of a storyline than actual reality for many communities of color. Deregulation actually have been meant more costly credit for communities of color, and it have been have increased variety of discriminatory creation, not only in the housing market, but in the credit industry, in the auto industry, payday industry, and buy here, pay here, punch ups, and the like. We have seen different type of marketing base, you know, place-based marketing, that we have seen it as financial services don't exist necessarily in communities of color. We have seen the plethora of predatory services coming in our communities as check cashier, pawn shops, and payday lending. And at the same time, we also have seen different auto lending products that actually have been very predatory to our communities. And, you know, I don't have to talk much about it, but definitely the increase then of predatory mortgage industry that actually not only have predatory in our community to low-income communities, but also have led those with prime rates or those that should have access to prime products actually have been steered to horrible products. In addition to that, you know, with asymmetric information, credit score, and the like, we also have seen mail marketing that actually have been discriminatory for communities of color. These have been, you know, put forward by the Federal Reserve study that pointed that less access to credit have been given to communities of color, controlling for a wide variety of factors. And our research at DEMOS and Center for American Progress and others have demonstrated that costly credit for communities of color actually, you know, Center for American Progress actually took data from the 1980s to currently today and look at deregulation of the financial market, and a great conclusion basically said that actually didn't necessarily first extended more credit to communities of color, and that those that were extended credit have more costly credit. In addition to that, one of example of those products, you know, National Consumer Law Center actually mentioned that targeting, you know, that you know, credit card companies actually have put fee harvesting cards in the house and having targeted this product to mainly communities of color. And this card, what it does is that you pay an incredible high fee to get this card, close to 200%, and actually your credit limit might be 500. So just using the card, you already have a balance of $200. This is purely predatory. I will give a little rundown in what we have seen in credit card industry, and please take it as a case study of how this industry have been, how this different industry have used, and particularly what is important, how affects the economic security of communities of color. As in credit card, deregulation actually changed the interest rate and fees of these communities. You know, in communities of color, more families have credit card debt. The level of credit card debt is actually higher than the total assets, and it has a higher impact of income. Actually, whites have a higher amount of credit card debt, but for communities of color, their credit card debt have a higher impact of asset and income. And in addition to that, particularly, we are offer costly credit, which hemorrhage, as I mentioned before, our income and assets, making it harder for family to stay afloat, but more importantly, to save, to have, you know, important ticket items that actually assist the process of economic mobility of buying a home, buying a car, or saving toward high education. Some examples of that is that we have seen, based on the 2004 survey, African Americans have, those that have credit card debt, 84% of them have debt, and Latinos, 79% have debt, while those that have credit card debt of whites, only 53% have credit card debt. Have costly credit. In the same survey, we find out that actually 22% of white have APRs, or interest rate higher than 20%, while blacks and Hispanics are closer to 30% of those communities that have higher, 20% of APR or higher. In addition to that, we also see that African Americans and Latinos cited that more times than not, they use their credit card to pay to basic necessities, to make that ends meet, that end of the month necessities. Actually, for whites, the number was closer to higher 30s, while for African Americans and Hispanic was closer to 40% of those communities to use that. So, I mean, it's not by surprise that, you know, we found that in 2004, white households had a median 15 cents of debt for every dollar of asset that they have, while blacks and Latinos have 23 and 24 cents of debt for every asset that they had. So, meaning they have, Latinos and Americans have more asset, more debt compared to their assets. And then, of course, pays more money. They pay more percentage of their income to credit card debt. So, you know, basically, the main point that I want to throw is that basically deregulation of the financial market has been set out of government outside of the equation of this supposedly free market enterprise. And actually, the industry actually have used this free space or predatory space to actually curtail bad products to low-income and communities of color, actually costing more for these communities. Actually, if you look at Greenspan's speeches in some time, it sounded like deregulation of the financial market was their de facto public policy for home ownership and democratization of credit and creating fair credit. And as we know at this point today, that this deregulation has been one of the main reasons, or you can say the main reason, particularly in the mortgage area, that we are in the trouble that we are today and how it's affected communities of colors. We think that it's important to create, you know, I think it's important that we deal with the issue that we're currently right now so important to many communities, but also that we look forward into policy that assists the process of regulating the industry. For that, Demos, think that there is a couple of ideas out there that actually are in the works. First, I want to mention the Financial Product Safety Commission. This is a commission that was put forward by Harvard professor Elizabeth Warren. That basically is, you know, as any other area of government, we actually monitor and regulate and actually make sure that consumers are well treated and actually have good products out there for consumption. We think that this is an area that it should do the same. A caveat that Demos have been working with other groups is that we should think that this Financial Product Safety Commission should have a raised lens due to that a lot of these predatory products are tested basically in our communities, are started in our communities. I think that the raised lens will first, you know, will use to protect our community, but also let other people, let the community at large of these bad products and hopefully curtail them and change minimize their impact and change and regulate those products that are actually harmful for communities. And this is being forwarded by Senate Durbin from Illinois, and it was co-sponsored by Schumer from New York and Kennedy from Massachusetts. I mentioned this because in terms of action, you know, this is actually just in committee, and so it's just sending a letter to them, letting them know that we think that this should be have a race lens into the Financial Product Safety Commission is a good way to start. The second, we're ready into committee, is the Credit Card Bill of Rights by Maloney, and the Card Bill of 2009 basically regulates the credit card industry, stopping areas as universal default, assist in the process of creating better credit limits, stopping interest rate increase, and actually, you know, one of the worst predatory instruments of the credit card industry is the fact that they actually can change the term for any time for any reason, and that will change that basically you will have a binding contract with them that you have a little more power. Second, I think a third one, and I will stop here, is that I think, you know, as Art has mentioned in a different report, is that I think we should increase the funding and power of federal civil rights agencies and expand the importance of these agencies to look at issues of financial regulation, but a wide variety of areas that regulatory apparatus is necessary as to regulate jobs and to also regulate, for example, environmental policy. With that, I will leave that. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Jose. Again, if you joined us late, that was Jose Garcia, the Associate Director for Research and Policy at Demos. You're listening to ARC's Compact Forum call on race and recession. If you have questions for Jose or for our other speaker, Bertha Lewis, CEO and Chief Organizer of ACORN, please email them to compact@arc.org. compact@arc.org. Bertha.
Well, thank you very much, Sam, and I want to thank ARC for doing this. I think it is very important to have this conversation because we throw around the R word, we throw around the D word, recession, depression, and all of this is economic repression. ACORN, as some of you know, is the largest membership organization of low and moderate income Americans in the country with over 400,000 member families. And the reason I repeat this is because we are the front ones on the line. We are on the front lines. ACORN members and people of color in this country are really the canaries in the economic mines. When we feel the effects coming, in many ways, the rest of the country takes a while to catch up with us. ACORN has been fighting predatory lending and subprime loans since 1999. For years, we have been saying that the mortgage industry is out of control. It's been steering first-time home buyers and those looking to refinance into subprime loans, and African Americans and Latino Americans were the initial targets of this kind of lending run amok. Their neighborhoods were targeted. They were sold loans that even if they qualified for prime loans, even if they had good credit, time and time again, not just ACORN, but other folks were able to show in study after study, as a result of these practices, how African Americans and Latino Americans and low-income communities were steered toward bad subprime loans. In 2002, we issued a report from ACORN called Separate and Unequal, and we revealed that subprime loans were taking over much of the mortgage market and replacing more affordable loans. You know, there's a saying that some of our members have when they are out in action: black and poor, you pay more. And this is not just a slogan. It is absolutely the truth in America right now, in this day and age. The progression of deregulation in the mortgage and banking industry not only was ratcheted up over the 8 years of the Bush administration, but sad to say, we can actually go back to the Clinton administration, when on one fateful day in Congress, President Clinton signed into law the H.R. 10 bill, which really broke down the walls of Glass-Steagall, which made it possible for banks to do the same thing as insurance companies, to do the same thing as other financial companies. And so that opened the door to the wild, wild west of Wall Street finance. That opened the door to more and more deregulation, which directly affected low and moderate income folks in this country, people of color, who were the canaries in the mine. But even more than that, because now we see the third wave of this foreclosure crisis. The first wave were poor people, people of color in low and moderate income neighborhoods. The second wave, which began to occur 5 or 6 years ago, began to hit more blue-collar workers, union workers. And you began to see a growing number of them who were not just black and brown, but also were low income and working class whites. And finally, we're in this third wave in which we are actually seeing the effects of these markets gone wild on high earning income Americans. I mean, we have million-dollar estates being foreclosed on because people did not have counseling and because the industry was allowed to just run amok with all the blessings of the Bush administration for the past 8 years. We also have seen that there has been a lessening and a decrease in programs to build affordable housing, such as affordable rentals. Not everyone in America is going to be able to own a home, nor should they. But everyone in America, especially those who are the least among us, low and moderate income folks and children, should have access to a decent, affordable housing situation. We have just abandoned rental programs. For instance, in New York City, Acorn participated in an almost 2-year campaign to save a complex called Starrett City. That was over 5,800 units of affordable housing, rental housing, that had been in an affordable program for 30 years. Once again, it was a target of being privatized, and we've seen the privatization of affordable housing rental programs all across the country. But finally, I think what we need to understand is the attack on poor people and people of color in this country by separating us. The immigration debate is a false debate about who has papers and who doesn't have papers. Immigrants are preyed upon, discriminated against, especially in the area of housing. Immigrants are targeted to pay enormous down payments on homes, and they are told you don't need any documents at all when it comes to buying a home and getting a subprime loan. And so they have been some of the worst victims of predatory lending. So we've got to make sure that folks know to look underneath the immigration debate and to see that it is really an economic debate and that immigrants, once again, are suffering more than any others, 3 times as bad as other Americans in this recession. So what Acorn has done is said enough is enough. And all across the country, we have been engaged in a national home defenders campaign. We are saying we have got to stop the foreclosure and subprime train. We have got to back up keep people in their homes. We have put together teams across the country that will defend folks from being evicted until they can get the help that they need. Right now, there's two key pieces that we would like for people to support. We absolutely need a strong bankruptcy bill, which will augment the Obama Home Affordable Modification Program. After passing in the House, it's been stalled in the Senate. I think that comes as no surprise. And there are reports that right now, as we speak, that bill is being watered down. And we need the leadership to drive through a strong piece of legislation that will make the Obama plan much stronger and implement the Obama plan while we try to keep people in their homes until help can be on the way. And number two, we need the creation of a mandatory mediation program modeled on the very successful Philadelphia model. We are calling on HUD to create a pot of funding for these types of programs, including community outreach to troubled borrowers. And so if folks want to take action, please go to ACORN's website, www.acorn.org, and sign up to be a home defender. Call your senator and make sure that they know they can't, that the world is watching, and that what they do to poor people, they will be visited back on them tenfold. We have to make sure that our elected officials do not water down President Obama's initiatives and his bills, and that we actually do try to correct 8 years of irresponsible deregulation, 8 years of the preying upon low and moderate income people who are the majority in this country, people of color. This has affected people of color more than any other group. And finally, we want to make sure that people know if you want to join in campaigns that take to the streets, if we have to, go to ACORN's website, sign up, and help us defend black and brown Americans to protect them in their homes until the Obama administration's foreclosure prevention programs can get to them. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Bertha. Again, that was Bertha Lewis, CEO and Chief Organizer for the Association of Community Organizations for Reform Now, ACORN. Bertha, the first question I have is actually for you, Bertha. It's from Marie in Oakland. And again, if others of you have additional questions, please email us at compact@arc.org. That's compact@arc.org. And Marie in Oakland asks, I have several friends who are losing their homes to foreclosure. How does the ACORN campaign work? How can people duplicate it in their area? What protections do you provide the homeowners in the communities that that do these campaigns?
Well, thank you, Marie, and I'm really glad that it's specific. First of all, let me tell you what to do. Call the ACORN helpline at 1-866-67-ACORN. That's 866-67-A-C-O-R-N. ACORN offices around the country are there to help you with your foreclosure problem. We will work with you to see if we can get a modification, help you with your documentation, explain all of these obscure terms that people use in the mortgage industry. And also, if you are in imminent danger or foreclosure and the bank just hasn't responded, call us immediately so that we can get you involved in the Home Defender campaign. And that would be trying to buy time to ward off the sheriffs that are coming to evict folks because banks have not responded or refused to modify folks' loans. Do you know that when a home is vacated, there is a direct proportional rise in crime, a lowering of the tax base. So it's not good for communities or neighborhoods to have abandoned homes. So call ACORN at 866-67-ACORN. Go to our website so that you can find out where the nearest office is for you. We can get you with a counselor and start working with you and others to modify your loans and at least have someone at your side to fight back with these banks who usually give you the brush off.
Great. Thanks very much, Bertha. Jose, next question is for you. What else can you tell us about the Financial Product Safety Commission and the proposals to include a racial lens and how you think that will help alleviate the situation?
So, you know, so the Financial Product Safety Commission, it's basically, I would say, in a skeleton form yet. So, but there are some principles. And the basic principle of the commission is the following, is that, you know, that we definitely need to regulate the market, but that products, financial products, vis-a-vis, you know, credit card, auto lending, mortgage, payday, and the like, should be go through some sort of a monitoring process that to make sure that those products are not only, you know, make money for the industry, but actually are good products for consumers. And the example that is usually used is that we do this in a wide variety of areas. You know, we have laws, maybe not the best, but that lead should be not used for painting. That certain consumer goods, you know, there's some lemon laws currently for cars. So this is a general rationale that government should protect consumers. And so basically monitoring, actually doing research and making sure that these products are good and see what products are being invented and what products should not be out there. And that this commission, it should be housed inside this regulatory, there's around 11 regulatory agency in the government. I know your question is, well, what the heck happened? But under that this commission should be housed underneath some of this, and that they should monitor and make sure that, and actually propose new good product for consumers. How would the race lens will work? It basically, it will make the commission actually look at products and actually desegregate the data. I mean, the general idea is close to the HMDA, right? Like in mortgages, even though they didn't stop the mess, but as Bertha was talking about, some groups were able to see this coming for a long, long time because based on this data, people were able to analyze the data and actually look what bad products look like and what people were affected by it. So in addition to not only having the data, we in the commission, you can actually make the necessary changes so these products don't go out to the community. So if we desegregate the data by race and ethnicity and so on, we can see how these products are affecting our communities. You see, if we just take the, you know, mortgage or credit card, for example, and we just look at the data without desegregated, maybe the interest rate we will not see, you know, you can just from the, basically, you can see interest rates that are not necessarily bad. We can also, you know, without desegregating data, basically, you can hide a lot of stuff that have been happening to a particular communities, in this case, communities of color. So we will be able to have a closer look on how these communities of color are being affected and stop those products for these communities. Let me just say again that the racial lens is actually not part of the commission currently, and that's, I think, what we can start. You know, you can email me, jgarcia@demos.org, jgarcia@demos.org, if you're interested in working something like this as we move forward. We're currently in conversation with different advocates in the general landscape of advocate out there to actually promote this idea to see how we can provide a racial lens. You know, we have some regulatory environments, and I will just say that regulation in itself will be better for communities of color, but not necessarily stop discrimination. So as we can put racial lens and actually assist the process of actually decreasing discrimination in the lending industry. Regulation is a great first step, but second is how do we make sure that we didn't get the most of the interest rate and fees brunt that we usually have been getting since the inception of the industry.
Great. Thanks very much, Jose. The next question is for Bertha. It comes from Anna Sidigu, the development assistant at McKenzie River Gathering Foundation in Portland, Oregon. She asks, could you talk more about the privatization of affordable housing programs?
Well, let me talk about HUD. For years, especially after World War II and in the 50s and 60s, as part of many sort of urban renewal programs, investors, landlords, developers were given incentives to build affordable rental housing. And, I mean, I grew up in rental housing. It wasn't until I was almost out of high school before my family could afford a house. And what you wanted was to have a decent, clean home. And most Americans were renting. So you had programs, I'll cite one like the Mitchell Lama program here in New York, where essentially the federal government and local governments gave tax breaks, subsidies, tax deferments for like 20-year programs, 30-year programs, 40-year programs if the owners, the developers, the landlords would keep these units and these complexes affordable. As we know, the Section 8 program was a huge benefit to poor Americans, black and white, and that program was gutted and began to phase out, and you had a situation in which landlords, owners were allowed to, you know, to really discriminate and say, I don't take Section 8. So there was a double whammy. Not the Section 8 vouchers were decreased drastically, and then you had landlords that were able to go unpunished by discriminating against people who had Section 8. And then third, you began to have a winding down of these programs in which the landlords got the benefits for having maintained affordable rental units for 20 and 30 years. And what speculators and developers found was, hey, I can buy out the owners of these complexes, do a little bit of, you know, patchwork fixing up, apply for more subsidies that don't have any strings attached, and then what I'll begin to do is systematically push out poor people and begin to raise the rents little by little by little until these rents become market rate rents, what they call them. And so you began to have a pricing out of traditional complexes. And then HUD, of course, began to get rid of and blow up the housing of last resort for poor people, which was public housing. So with the demise of public housing, the gutting of the Section 8 program, the subsidy programs that were beginning to come to end and allowing private developers to privatize them. All of these forces have come together to really decimate affordable rental housing. And then this whole hysteria that swept the nation, why rent when you can buy? And therefore, that door opened to predatory lenders, subprime loans. And so the foreclosure crisis is the other side of the coin of the affordable rental crisis.
All right, thanks very much, Bertha. The next question we have is from Alan Preston in Seattle, Washington. I think really either of you can address this. What is the role of private philanthropy in addressing the impact of the crisis on communities of color? So what is the role of private philanthropy in addressing the impact of the crisis on communities of color? And what innovative funding strategies are you aware of right now? Jose, you want to start us off there? And we have about 8 to 10 minutes left for questions, and we'll wrap this up.
I mean, I think Bertha might be able to talk more about this topic. I think I think we should be mindful that this is a catastrophe of public policy, and therefore government will have to play an important part on this. This is a history of bad public policy that we have seen since the inception of the redlining and the ghettoization of communities of color, and now with the deregulation of the financial market, particularly in this case of mortgages. So I think that clearly philanthropic giving have a role here, but I will put a lot of my emphasis that this is clearly a government needs to put a lot of thinking of how to regulate an industry that have basically, bring all of us with them as they have fallen. An industry that makes 30% of the GDP, that makes 30% of the U.S. economy, so it's too much of a big part of the economy. It's basically have been built upon a house's card as deregulation, but also we haven't been put attention of the securitization process, which basically is what provided a lot of money to this area and actually have put a lot of incentives to create deceptive and horrible products. And I think the way that we can actually regulate the industry, the economy would be safer. That's clear. But second, our communities will be safer, and this is not an issue, of course, of we need to educate ourselves more. We need to a government that protects consumers for bad products. That protects, that's one of the main role of government, to protect its community, all of us, from any type of market-based products. So I will leave it at that.
Well, I think, Jose is absolutely right. There is a role for government, and government has got to play its part. But the question is about private philanthropy, and I want to hit that one head on, and I want to hit it through a lens of color. We need private philanthropy to step up to the plate now more than ever. There has been an abject failure over the past 8 years for the government to take responsibility. And, in fact, the government has been your main offender. So we do need for foundations and private individuals to give of their dollars and make an investment in America. By what? They need to help organizations, and I know this is going to sound self-serving, but hey, as Jose said, I'll just put it out there. Organizations like Demos and Acorn and others across this country to shore up our infrastructure so that there's many organizations, nonprofit, grassroots organizations, that should not have to depend for a large percentage of their funding from the government. Number two, private philanthropy has got to have the courage to stand up and fight back and not to be afraid of being attacked from the right, from the far right. We need more funding to do more research so that we can actually make the studies, make the case, put it out there. And also we need private philanthropy to actually fund direct action for heaven's sakes, unless you organize poor people, because they have the numbers, and unless you can attack this from a policy point of view, as well as on the streets, you will never highlight the problem. You will never be able to give grassroots organizations the tools to fight back against big industry and big corporations. So yes, private philanthropy has an important role to play now more than ever to fund organizations to do the real fighting and taking on of government so that government can actually do their job. We still do need advocacy. We need social service. We do need development. But you've got to be able to take a more aggressive stand, as the right wing does, and the innovative funding that I've seen coming out of private philanthropy has been coming from the right, and we need more progressive private philanthropy to help those of us who are progressive, who are on the streets, who are fighting this day by day by day. We can't afford the big ads in the newspapers. We can't afford the glossy periodicals. And so we need private philanthropy now more than ever.
I mean, let me just add what Bertha said, because I think she hit the nail. I mean, it's when you, and that's what I guess I mentioned, the whole issue of financial education. You know, this is, you know, for the longest time it was a blame game, basically. That individuals that see that you got the product that you can advocate yourself for. And there was a lot of that in the industry, and we thought that was, you know, that a lot of the philanthropy thought that was the way to go. I mean, I think what makes this very clear in this crisis is that it's not an issue of education. You know, I don't know if you have seen those home ownership packages that the lawyer put in front of you, but they're like 500 pages. And I don't think any rich person, or because of, you know, they're white or anything, they're actually reading more than anybody else and understand more than anybody else, either for in the credit card industry. It's impossible to understand some of these pricing mechanisms. And it's not because of they know better, they know less. You know, it's an issue. It's an issue of who these products go to. And I think philanthropy can play a great role in this area by providing the necessary tools that Bertha mentioned, from organizing to research to communication to actually fortify the infrastructure that actually can fight with an industry, as she mentioned, have billions of dollars to put forward. And we've just seen it, you know, currently with the bankruptcy bill of 2005. We've seen it again with the credit card industry, and we see it again with TARP. How the industry, even in the midst of this demise, are putting a bunch of money actually to actually fight back some of the regulation that actually may benefit their bottom line.
Great. Now, you know, I'd like to wrap up with one last question. It's a combination of a question from Joe Brooks, who's the Vice President for Civic Engagement at Policy Link, and a question that I have for you guys. So Joe's asking, you know, how do you see the politics playing out with the Obama administration? You know, how can we encourage the Obama administration to move on these ideas around, you know, regulating and re-regulating the financial system? And I'd like to add to that, you know, how do we respond generally to those who argue, you know, as I mentioned in the introduction, you know, that now is not the time. We're starting to hear a lot of that now is not the time to increase minimum wages. Now is not the time for comprehensive immigration reform that will lead to legalization of immigrants. That now is not the time for other, you know, expansive economic programs. So how do we answer those critics, that pushback? Again, how do you see the politics playing out with the Obama administration?
Well, first of all, Dom and everyone, when have we not heard that now is not the time for anything that is
absolutely
for anything that benefits poor people, anything that would benefit people of color in this country? Acorn fought for 10 years to try to pass the minimum wage. 10 years it took. It was never the time, but it was always the time for capitalism. It's always the time for deregulation. It's always the time for trickle down. Well, if not now, when? You know, and if not us, who? This is the absolute time to do this. We have got to put this ship to rights. I think the political question here is our political will. There are no saviors. You know, there's not going to be some knight in shining armor that's going to come in and save the day. We have got to be on the streets. We have got to be in the research offices. We have got to be in the legislative offices. We've got to be in the boardrooms and the courtrooms. We've got to be every single place. Because you know what? We not only have to show the regressive forces in this country that we're fed up, the time is now, and enough is enough. But we also have to really come out and support the Obama agenda. I think the Obama administration has really stepped up to the plate and put forth bold initiatives, the stimulus and the budget and the change in its policy proposals. It is up to us politically to show that, yes, this is the right thing to do, that, no, don't worry about paying a price from the right politically. We are there. We got your back. We will be everywhere. We are going to push to make sure that this budget is passed, and we're not going to let the historic election where people came together dissipate. I think that is what we have to do politically to make sure that this administration knows that we're going to keep on fighting with and alongside the administration until we get health care, a real housing plan, energy, education, until we get all of those initiatives passed. And we're not going to flag. If we sit back and say, oh, you know, we've got a progressive president, and say, well, you guys do it over there on the Hill, it's not going to happen. The right is not resting, and neither should we. So politically, we have to show that we are putting our shoulders to the wheel to make sure that the policies that the Obama administration has put forward is actually carried through, and that we mean to see them enacted.
I mean, Jose, do you have anything to add in the last minute here?
Yes, I think that I think we have a movement from, you know, we have a movement, and I think Obama, I think, have movement in a different direction. I think it's up to us to change that. However, the issue of race and communities of color is not necessarily, we definitely are moving ideological to a different position. However, it doesn't necessarily mean that issue of communities of color are going to be in the front table. In when we discuss this issue, it's up to community advocates, it's up to policy and research, you know, media, to try to make the case that in a devastating time, and where communities of color have been, you know, in the forefront of devastation, it's time that these inequities, the historical inequities based on public policy, are taken in consideration to actually raise all boats out of this disaster.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. I'd like to thank both of our speakers, Jose Garcia of Demos and Bertha Lewis of Acorn, for their participation today. I'd like to thank you all for listening in. I'd also like to encourage you all to check out our Compact for Racial Justice webpage at arc.org and urge you to sign our pledge for racial justice. We hope that you'll review the resources that we have at www.arc.org/compact, where you'll find this, an MP3 audio of this full call and our past calls as well. You can also find Jose's blog titled Tough Times Are Nothing New for Communities of Color at our racewire.org blog. You can reach Jose at jgarcia@demos.org. And as Bertha mentioned earlier, if you're interested in those, in Acorn's Home Defender Team's helpline, that's 1-866-67-ACORN. Again, 1-866-67-ACORN. Thank you very much. I also like to strongly encourage you all to join us April 28th, that's in 2 weeks, when we wrap up with the series with a 100-day review of the Obama administration, and on May 12th we'll be releasing ARC's Race and Recession Report on these very topics. Thanks for joining us, and have a great day.